This is Radioactive Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
Okay, this is Craig Lubon. Thank you for joining us here on Radioactive Magazine. My guest today is Michael Sharman Crawford. He is an attorney in Kansas City, Missouri.
Correct.
And specializes in immigration law. And so you can guess that that will be our topic tonight. We get to talk about immigration. And we will include talking about the couple of the most recent Supreme Court decisions. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you. So, I'm glad we're talking about immigration because I really don't know how to do anything else. So okay. That's good for us.
So tell me what some of the most recent developments are. I know, I think your partner was on, talked about the caravan on Jaws of Justice, I believe.
Correct.
So you might talk about that some, since we, although we have an overlapping audience, there are some listeners who might not have heard about that.
Well, there's the first piece is what's going on at the border. So to recap, you have the Central American, the big three Central American countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. People are fleeing the gang violence and the institutional gang violence that occurs in those countries. And when they hit the Mexican-U.S. border, they're bottling up there. And the U.S., in an attempt to dissuade folks from coming to the United States to seek protection, has been forcing some of those asylum seekers to come in the United States, make a claim, and then go back and stay in Mexico, which is causing them to be victimized in Mexico. Aside from them being victimized, we think that that practice of allowing them in the United States and then sending them back out of the United States happens to be illegal. So there's a lot of litigation going on around that. And that continues to be an issue to say, how do we address the needs of those folks that are coming from the Central American countries and their claims, and how do those square with asylum law in the United States? We saw some changes last summer with the Attorney General under Mr. Sessions, where he decided to take decisions under his own authority and make changes to the asylum law as it applied to domestic violence victims, as it applied to gang members, or gang people being threatened by the gangs in those three countries. So those cases are still being litigated. A district court stepped in about part of that, and there's an injunction as to the domestic violence part. So that's the asylum caravan aspect of immigration.
On the changes that Attorney General Sessions made, is there any indication that the new Attorney General might back off on some of that, or is he rubber stamping what Sessions did?
There's a bit of hint that he's going to continue to move forward with the agenda that he's handed. I don't think that either Attorney General truly is the architect behind this. I think this is a leftover Bannon project and a current Stephen Miller project. And so then whatever gets funneled to the Department of Justice is then acted on. I know that some of Mr. Barr's writings have not been favorable to immigration positions. So we'll see if he has time to step into that fray, or if post-Mueller investigation he's going to be busy chasing fires of retribution to those dissenters among the president.
Okay, and I know who Steve Bannon is that you referred to. Tell me a little bit about, I've heard the name Steve Miller. What position does he have?
Stephen Miller was actually a aide to Mr. Sessions when he was in the Senate, and Stephen Miller is now the immigration advisor or whisperer to the president to be the architect for some of these immigration changes and responses to immigration issues that arise, such as the asylum issues at the border. As we well know, the border wall is coming through, so this particular area of immigration, that having to do with southern border entrance, is of particular interest to the president. So anything that applies to folks who come in through that passageway is going to continue to be something that the administration is going to make changes to at least attempt to corral.
Okay. And when these people come to the United States and they're sent then to wait in Mexico, I assume then that the Mexican government has agreed to that?
Well, that's kind of the problem, is that the Mexican government is kind of upset about it because it's flooding Ciudad Juarez and Tijuana and some of those border cities and causing them to have issues with that population. The population is then becoming falling prey to Mexico's own transnational organizations or gangs or street gangs. And so you're having an increase in crime at the border in Mexico. So Mexico was already not happy with them being bottlenecked at the U.S. border. And now that they're being recycled, so to speak, that's causing problems in Mexico. So that's straining the U.S.-Mexican relationship as we speak. Not to mention that there is collusion between the American government and, I guess that's a bad word these days, but there is collusion between the Mexican government and the American government as to activists and lawyers and journalists who are traveling back and forth across the borders to document and assist in this situation. There was a list prepared by CBP that caused some people to be deported from Mexico or not allowed to enter Mexico, and other people that weren't allowed to enter the United States and vice versa. So there's a number of issues that go on with that border issue.
Okay. And if Mexico were to stop allowing that, what would we be able to do? Would these people be waiting in the United States then, or will we be deporting them back to the countries they came from?
Well, once they came into the United States and they are given their credible fear interviews and they're allowed to remain in the United States because they've demonstrated a credible fear of removal, or excuse me, a credible fear of persecution in their home country, then they are normally allowed to remain in the United States. So they can be detained during that period, or they can be released into the United States. And, of course, that's the last thing that everybody wants to have happen, is them to be, everyone in the government, to be released into the United States. So if Mexico were to draw a line, the United States government's already detaining some 50,000 non-citizens as it is, and they don't have bed space. So they would be released into the United States to await their trial, await the results of all of their other immigration proceedings. And that's ostensibly what the American government is trying to avoid at this point.
Okay. And let's go a little bit through the phrase credible fear. That's the first thing they have to show, is that if they're going to apply for asylum.
So what they do is they walk in and they say that I'm seeking asylum. They're deemed to be arriving aliens. They have no documentation. And so they're given an interview by an asylum officer who asks them why they fear returning to their country of origin, and then makes a decision simply to see if they could make a credible claim for persecution. It isn't binding. It is simply an interview to determine roughly what they fear, why they fear it, and does that have a cognizable claim within asylum law. If they come to the border and they say, I like to live in blue houses and there aren't any blue houses in my country, that's really not going to be a cognizable claim to asylum. But fears of violence, fears of gang retribution, some countries the gangs have taken on the color of political parties, and there may be a political bend to the gang violence that exists in a couple of countries. All of that's analyzed, and if it's a credible fear that could move forward to a full hearing in front of an immigration judge, then they're allowed to move forward.
Okay. And how does one establish credible fear? I'm thinking that probably 50% of the people on the planet are living in countries where they could make that claim.
And it depends on the relevant country conditions on where you are seeking that asylum from. And so it's, in that case, it's usually in a narrative, meaning they just tell a story. Most of the time in an asylum situation, no one really expects you to have the person trying to kill you sign a note that says, yes, I'd like to kill Bob, and this is why, and then you can bring that and say, see, Bob, this gentleman wants to kill me. So for the most part, in that initial scenario, it's a narrative storytelling. And those asylum officers have to balance all of the stories they hear with what this person is telling them, with what they understand the country conditions to be, which the watering down of the State Department reports is a whole nother problem. We can spend another half hour with that one. But based on what current country conditions and what current intelligence tells us that is going on in those countries, whether the person appears to be credible, the details they give are relevant and cogent through their narrative, then that person can then make a decision as to whether or not that's a credible fear.
All right. And if the initial hearing officer finds that there is a credible fear, what are the next steps then?
So then if they're in detention, frequently they're released on either a bond or on their own recognizance to go then appear before an immigration judge. The immigration courts are backed up everywhere. Here, just in Kansas City, one of our judges is setting hearing dates in March of 2022 because that's when he has his next available court date. We have a park date, a false date in 2020 for another judge until he can figure out what his calendar is, which would be in 2020 or 2021. So the ones at the border in those border states are even more backed up. So if those people say, yes, I have relatives in Minnesota, then they'll release them, let them go to Minnesota, go to court up there to relieve some of that pressure that's existing at the border. And so then they can detain people who are reentrants after being deported, who don't pass credible fear, who have other issues that they have more of a desire to detain that person than a man and his child, a family, a woman and her child, or an individual that presents a credible fear.
Okay. And so if they show the credible fear and then they have a hearing in front of the court, what is it, essentially the same thing that they convince that judge of, that they have a credible fear, or is there more?
If it's an asylum claim, if they've acted within a year of their arrival in the United States, then they are seeking or attempting to demonstrate that they have a reasonable fear of either, they've either experienced past persecution, they've already been persecuted on account of their race or their religion or their nationality, their membership in a particular social group or their political opinion, or they have a reasonable fear of future persecution on account of one of those criteria. So, for example, a woman from Guatemala who's indigenous, who's been subject to physical abuse by male family members, boyfriends, and has no education, has no means to make a living, and fears returning to be placed back into that abusive relationship, may be able to demonstrate that she is of a particular social group, whether we base that on gender or her indigenous heritage or both, and that on account of that, that the view of indigenous women in Guatemala is so low that she would be subjected to that. She's been subjected to persecution because she simply doesn't exist as far as Guatemalan society is concerned, or would be subjected to that persecution in the future, that abuse in the future, and then that would be her asylum claim that she would need protection from.
Okay. And in terms of establishing family abuse and stuff, is there also a requirement that they show that the country they're coming from is not capable or willing to offer them reasonable protection?
Yes, the government has to be, remember, the persecution has to be by the government or by someone that the government is unwilling or unable to prevent that persecution. And so in those three countries, again, going back to gender, they have a pretty atrocious record on women's rights, especially indigenous women. And so the background material on that is pretty prevalent. And historically, that's been a pretty clear pattern, regardless of almost economic stature or racial stature, meaning you're part of an indigenous community or you're part of the Spanish colonial mix that is now the dominant population. It doesn't really matter who you are. If you're female, you're at a second place in those countries for the most part anyway. And so that piece, based with a credible testimony, perhaps some letters, perhaps medical records that exist, that are able to round out that story, or what is key to a successful case.
How would they get medical records and that type of stuff if they come here without documents?
A lot of records are historical. You call the hospital up and say, was she a patient at this time? Okay. Some of the clinics still have those. Some of the, depending on where she went or didn't go, letters from family. As we move forward in technology, even in some of those countries, everybody has a cell phone. In rare cases, but more frequently, you're starting to see people that whose family members have photos on a cell phone that they can email to you and those kinds of things.
And you kind of focused on women as being the predominant group that's affected by this. What about in some of your African countries where LGBT issues are significant, and particularly like Uganda?
Yeah, Uganda's the forefront of LGBTQ problems in Africa. But you have some in Kenya, you have some in Tanzania, you have, I'm trying to think, one more. It's still that's a shifting landscape in the sense that one minute it's illegal and one minute it's not. And that becomes a problem in the litigation if the country says, well, we're going to pass a law. Well, great. A law with no teeth is still ineffective. But the government that we litigate against always want to rely on, well, the country is making changes. The country is doing these things. Well, the country's been inactive. So then it almost becomes a battle of either experts or the historical documentation, the intelligence that is going on now with those particular cases in those countries. And then, again, you're back to the logical narrative. That person has to be able to cogently talk about their LGBTQ history. How are they in that community? When did that begin? What are their relationships? It's not just a magic formula that you just could say, well, I'm gay and this is going to work out. Even in Mexico, there's a huge difference in the way transgender people are treated than simply gay people are treated. And it depends on where you are. If you're in rural Mexico, both are bad. But if you're in Mexico City, there's much more tolerance. So that it becomes a shifting sand of to where are you going to be able to go and where are you not going to be able to go.
With the LGBT people, are they treated essentially the same as women in terms of establishing credible fear, or is there discrimination by the courts here against that?
No, I think they're treated relatively similar because there's more of a willingness. I don't know that that's correct in the sense that I was going to say there's more of a willingness to look at LGBTQ issues. And I guess I'll stick with that vein in this sense. Judges are more reluctant to find that gender, that women blanket are going to be harmed, than LGBTQ issues are as a blanket to be harmed. And I think part of that is because they believe there's a smaller population. One of the giant fears of the government is the floodgates, opening the floodgates to everyone. Well, if you say every woman in Central America or even in some African countries, every woman is going to be discriminated against or persecuted on account of their gender alone, well, then everybody's head starts to spin that everybody from those countries is suddenly going to come here. All those women are going to come here, and you've created this large population. So when you look at LGBTQ issues, from a numbers perspective, it's smaller. So I think it's more palatable to the government to say, well, there's only a few of those. It's pretty heinous. It's okay to say, if you've established that you're this person or you belong to this classification of people, then we're more eager to agree to that than we are just a simple gender claim.
And when you have people coming from countries like Syria and stuff, the refugees, do they have, is it the same standards that apply to them?
It is. And if you come as a refugee, then you've been pre-cleared to already be demonstrated to that, and you come in, entered as a refugee, a year after that, you automatically get your green card. If you've come some other way, then yes, it's the same standard. We had some Syrians who'd come from one of the Nordic Northern European countries first. They'd gone there first and had found that they were being discriminated against there, and then came to the United States from there. And so we had to show that they hadn't had a permanent status in that country first, and even if they had, they were still being persecuted against in that country, and they would be persecuted in Syria. Right. So it was a two-step process.
And let me move to the issue of indefinite detention. The Supreme Court, by 5-4 decision, just allowed indefinite detention in some narrow class of cases. Can you tell us about that?
So the case is pre-op, written, penned by Justice Alito. And it literally took me about 2.5 days. I felt like I was in law school. I had my colored pencils out. I had my highlighters out because it's very grammar heavy. And Justice Alito begins by dicing up the statute that's at play and explaining why the grammar controls the meaning. And so the issue in that case isn't necessarily about indefinite detention, but it's about that if someone has a criminal offense that makes them removable and makes them subject to mandatory detention, then there's language in the statute that says they must be taken into custody when released from the criminal custody. And the argument was that when released meant immediately, as you walk out the jail door. And there's some balance to that because ICE detainers are civil in nature, and the local jails don't have authority to necessarily hold people just on ICE's request, because the local sheriff doesn't have a federal commission and he's not an immigration officer, so he can't arrest somebody for a civil detention document. So pre-op said the when released doesn't mean immediately from the jail door, because everybody that didn't get held or every detainer that didn't get honored would let somebody go free and then they could have a bond, and that's clearly what the statute didn't mean. So 17 pages into the decision of wading through grammar and all of Justice Alito's attempt to rationalize based on the language alone, he essentially abandons that argument and then turns around and says, look, the duty of the government is done better late than never. And so even if we concede that when released means when that person walks out of the jail door, ICE should be waiting for them and pick them up, that doesn't matter because ICE's job is to arrest people, and that job is done better late than never. So we can really just do it anytime we want to. And in the end, that's the way that he concludes his opinion, is to say, yep, we just get to do it because, well, we're the government and that was our duty and we should be able to do it. In reality, it doesn't change a lot. We've litigated that issue here in the district courts and in the circuit courts, and to no avail. And so in that regard, we weren't treading. It would have been nice for us because it would have opened a new avenue for our clients here. But for the last several years, we've been faced with the attitude that it doesn't matter when they get arrested anyway. If they're subject to mandatory detention, then that's what they're subject to.
And when they're detained under that act, though, they still get hearings before being deported, is that correct?
If they're eligible, yes. If they're eligible for relief, then their relief gets heard. It's just that they don't get a bond to get out and take advantage of the long hearing dates. They're going to have a hearing within a couple of months, and then the resolution is that. And they may not get out even during appeal, although once you get past 6 months of detention, you may get into the question of do they deserve a bond hearing or not. That was the Supreme Court's decision in Jennings, and there's still some holes in that decision. So the longer they're detained, even during proceedings, I think the water gets a little murkier as to say when do they actually get to be released.
All right. And since this decision was interpreting a statute very narrowly, is there still a concern that it might be an omen for what's to come in terms of constitutional issues with this court?
Yeah, I think this one is this decision gives us a view of the darker side of this court and the arguments that were just held on the redistricting. There's some quotes by Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh. Justice Gorsuch was asking, why should we even get involved in this? Isn't this a state's issue? Isn't this a legislative issue? Why are we getting involved? And I believe you're going to start to see some conservative view of statutory construction and a conservative view of the court's position and power and duties. Although, with respect to immigration, there has been a long history of deferring to the agency's interpretation of things. It's called Chevron deference, and the case is Chevron. And Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh are not big fans of Chevron deference. They believe that if the agency is patently misinterpreting something, then they shouldn't give it deference, that Chevron deference is irrational, and that the law should state what the law is, and they are the supreme analyzers, if you will, of the law, and so they should be empowered to make that decision. In that regard, there could be some interesting tumult in the court as some of these Chevron deference cases start rising up through the ranks to meet with this conservative court.
All right, and we're almost out of time. Are there some websites that you would recommend that people look at for more information on these issues?
Yeah, I think I must give a shout-out to my partner who does a fantastic job of keeping our Facebook page for Sharma Crawford Attorneys at Law updated with everything current that unfolds. The American Immigration Lawyers Association, the ACLU, the National Immigration Project of the National Lawyers Guild, and the American Immigration Council all have amazing websites that can go deeper into these situations as well as current information. But current, up-to-date, hot-button issues, I think our Facebook page is probably one of the best sources right now.
Right. And you mentioned, too, before, with the when they come out of jail, and so they usually don't get a bond and stuff. Is the waiting time for that type of case as long as the asylum cases, or is it typically shorter waiting?
If they're detained, the immigration judges under their new mandates to handle so many cases a year and not get overturned in appeals, things that give them great incentive to move the docket along rapidly, they have to they're supposed to complete a detained case within 90 days. Mm-hmm. Most of them still take a couple of months. But there is some very fast movement of immigration cases. Some of our judges are having two and three trials a day as opposed to the old history of having one trial in the morning and one trial in the afternoon because some of these immigration hearings last 4 hours. We have some judges that are stacking two and three cases in an afternoon in an effort to move things along. The last piece is there is a Supreme Court case that just got taken by the court recently for... It'll come up on the October calendar for argument. It's Garcia out of the Supreme Court of Kansas. And so this is an ID theft case where the Supreme Court of Kansas held that the use of Social Security numbers and other documents from employment can't give rise to the state charge of identity theft. It doesn't do anything that if you're in Kansas and you have a false driver's license. This is about when a law enforcement officer goes into an employer and takes the false Social Security card that you're using and charges you with identity theft through the state of Kansas in this regard. The state attorney general took an appeal from the Supreme Court's decision that said that was improper and contrary to the federal government's authority to control immigration because that's what those documents are, and there's some statutory authority that support that. So they took an appeal to the Supreme Court. This lingered for about a year or two to wait for a response from the Solicitor General. The Solicitor General weighed in and said yes, that they threw their support behind the state. The problem is that now runs contrary to two or more cases where the AG in the previous Department of Justice came out and said that the employment area of this, where it overlaps with immigration, is within the sole province of the federal government. So that's going to be an interesting question that comes up this October that will have a direct relationship back to Kansas.
All right. Thank you. We are out of time. For those just joining us, we've been talking to Michael Sharma Crawford, an immigration attorney.